evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Monday, May 21st, 2018. Very little progress is being reported at the talks in Addis. If a deal is not reached, what happens?
In case the parties fail to reach an agreement, it will be important now for IGAD, the African Union, and the international community to impose a peace agreement that must be implemented.
And South Sudanese refugees say, give peace a chance.
The life in the refugee camp is somehow so simple, but not that easy. When you are in the refugee camp, you think of what happened back at home.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. After 4 days of closed-door negotiations, officials say South Sudan's warring parties have made some progress on security issues at the high-level revitalization forum in the Ethiopian capital.
On the security arrangements, people have agreed on the contentment. They have agreed on Article 2. Article 2 is agreed, and this is connected with the contentment areas. Article 3 is also agreed on the same, and Article 7 is also agreed. These are the articles which are agreed on the security arrangements. And this is where we have made real progress.
Information Minister Michael McQuay offered that assessment just minutes after emerging from a plenary session of the party delegates this evening. He says the parties have agreed on the separation of all the forces, assembly and containment. They have also agreed on reforming the security sector and unification of the forces, according to McQuay, but failed to agree on a timeline period for that process. McQuay says little process has been made on the governance issues. The parties failed to agree on power-sharing ratios and a government structure, which has all along been one of the toughest issues to resolve between government and opposition representatives at the talks. He says the parties have also agreed to build trust and confidence, discuss the root causes of the conflict, and respect the cessation of hostilities agreement signed late last year. But overall, concessions made by the warring parties have not amounted to much. Opposition groups accuse the government of failing to compromise, an accusation that McQuay denies.
All those who say so are those who never moved even an inch from their positions from then up to now.
Peter Mayen, chair of the National Alliance, which is an umbrella group of 8 opposition political parties, says the warring parties lack political will to resolve the conflict, and that's hindering efforts to make a breakthrough.
Each and every party want to stick to their position. If you look at the consultations that was done earlier by the IGAD team, it is the same proposal that were there in the consultation. And at the same time right now, it's the same proposal that are still being proposed by the party.
Pagana Moom, a member of the South Sudan Opposition Alliance, a coalition of 9 opposition parties, says certain politicians' refusal to give up power is one of the biggest challenges to reaching a lasting peace deal. That and the government's refusal to work with rebel leader Riek Machar. Should the parties completely fail to agree on a comprehensive deal, Pagan suggests all the current political leaders, including his coalition, should step aside and a government of technocrats led by South Sudanese be established. The government rejects that idea. IGAD officials say 2 more days have been added to the party delegates to give them more time to negotiate and agree on the security and governance issues. Again, Pagan Amum.
In case the parties fail to reach an agreement, it will be important now for IGAD, the African Union, and the international community to impose a peace agreement that must be implemented.
Despite a cessation of hostilities agreement signed last December, fighting among the warring parties continues, a move that's been condemned by observers. While the parties continue to talk, Akwaka Jong, a member of the Civil Society Alliance at the talks, says his group has this message.
All the warring parties and other political parties must commit themselves to silent guns, stop the war, and bring peace to our nation. Our people cannot continue to suffer.
Church officials, who are the mediators at this current round of talks, have declined to speak to reporters, saying they have not yet pulled together their minutes. That report was prepared by Waki Simon Wudu in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. South Sudanese refugees in Uganda have called on the warring factions in their country to make peace so they can go home. Their plea comes as another round of the peace talks is underway in Ethiopia, steered by the East African Bloc, IGAD, and the mediators of the church leaders. A number of agreements have been signed before and later broken, the latest in 2017. VOA's Catherine Nambi files this report from Kampala.
Ugandan refugee settlements are home to more than 1 million South Sudanese who have fled fighting in their country. Uganda government and refugee agencies provide many of the necessities to help the refugees settle and start a new life. Still, many yearn to return home. Grace Madut, a 17-year-old from Kajokeji in South Sudan, breaks down in tears, remembering the family she left behind.
The life in the refugee camp is somehow so simple, but not that easy. When you are in the refugee camp, you think of what happened back at home, your relatives and then others. We just wish to go back home, be with my relatives and everybody.
Madut is not alone. Bashandiru Araba is another South Sudanese refugee from Yeye River State. She wants peace to return to her motherland so her family can reunite.
I just the first person even like to go back when the feast come. What I miss, because, you know, relatives are not come in the same place. Some relatives, they don't know where they go. So we divide us different. But now the what making me peace to go back, we can come all the relatives and combine in the same place.
Samuel Era is an elder among the Nuela tribe of South Sudan, but he lives now in Uganda's Bidibidi settlement. He says the long stay in the settlements puts their community's traits under attack. He says intermarriage is diluting the cultural values of various South Sudanese tribes in the settlements.
Our cultural marriages have changed. Now people don't marry their own, you know, cultural mates, and because of the setup of the refugee camps. You find your neighbor is from another tribe. If she is beautiful, you find that you will marry that one now.
The refugees are now calling for cessation of hostilities among leaders in the country so they can safely go home. Taban Wilson is from Kajokeji.
The government should really settle the issue amicably so that people go back. We will be very happy because it has taken a long.
Wadri Sam Nyakua is the chairperson of Arua District, where most of the South Sudan refugee settlements in Uganda are. He wants the world to do more to help the refugees and his community.
I want to appeal to the international community to invest yourselves in solving this problem back home in South Sudan. The UN has all the powers to put sanctions, to bring to order these warring factions. This aid and support and so on we're giving, yes, it is good, but it can help us and address the problem in South Sudan. It will be a very, very wonderful thing.
South Sudan's civil conflict began in December 2013 when political disputes between President Salva Kiir and former Vice President Riek Machar turned violent. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
Residents of Goli Village in Yei River State's Tor County area say they live in fear following last week's massacre by unidentified gunmen. 10 people were killed, including children, at a Christian college there. Hundreds have fled the area. Daniel Friday Martin has more for VOA from Yei.
An eyewitness who fled the area says the attack happened at the Emmanuel Christian College compound, located 20 miles along the Yei Meridi Road. Speaking on condition of anonymity for fear of reprisals, the eyewitness says hundreds of residents fled into the bushes or to the neighboring Democratic Republic of Congo after seeing people being killed in the front of their eyes.
I was so shocked when I saw really blood flowing like in a butcher, and seeing a children being killed innocently like that is really something not good. When we saw us being rounded by armed men, and it tells us that even if you are in the church, you are not safe. My appeal is, as a civilian, we need really to emphasize on peace.
That appeal has been repeated by thousands of South Sudanese who have been suffering since the conflict broke out. Goli Village resident George Malis fled to Yei Town following the attack. He's calling on authorities to find the gunmen and punish them.
Those who perpetrators has to be brought to book, then justice has to be done on them. Then my worry is most of the people have left their villages, so what we were emphasizing on is they have to give for us food items. We want the place to be peaceful so that we can be in position of moving freely. Basically, on protection of civilians, currently we are worried. My calling on the government is they have to totally assure us on our protection.
Daniel Ohide, principal of the Emmanuel Christian College, says the victims were 5 primary school pupils, 3 compound guards and 2 internally displaced persons.
Our office was broken, our library offices were looted, and also one of our staff children was raped, a 14-year-old girl. We are totally devastated by this.
Ohide is urging security agencies in the state to track down the attackers and bring them to justice. He says the college will remain closed until the area is secured. Huda Michael Laida, the Yeh River State Minister for Law Enforcement, condemned the attack and says authorities are investigating.
The government has formed a high-level committee to investigate this violation, which led to losses of life. The government reassures the people of the state and the Ture County in particular, while waiting the result of the investigation to remain calm, because the agreement was very clear that the SPLIO and the SPLA forces of the government, they are supposed to base on their locations.
Why Godwill, a member of the SPLIO operating the area, denies his group carried out the attack on the Emmanuel Christian College compound.
We never had any clash on the side of Tore this way. Actually, if there was any clash, we would have reported to citizens and the other bodies that are monitoring the ceasefire. So there was nothing that there was a fight. It was just a business claim. Actually, we condemn this kind of assaults against civilians.
Godwill is appealing to the ceasefire and transitional security arrangements monitoring mechanism to investigate the attack. For VOA News, I'm Daniel Friday Martin in Yeh.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. President Salva Kiir orders police officers working at Juba International Airport to be removed. Find out why when we come back.
Think. People speak out on important questions. The question today.
What do you miss most about being a kid?
What I miss about being a kid, I miss playing. Because now I don't have a time for playing. That's why I miss it. Now I'm busy reading, doing something else, cooking.
I have missed good care, and also I miss playing with my toys. That's all that I miss.
Actually, what I miss about the kid is the care my family gave to me when I was young. All the games we used to play with my fair friends, and all whatever we did in the first were my only, especially my mother.
I was being loved so much by my parents. And at this moment, I'm an adult, so I have to cater for myself. I have to cater for my bills. They do love me the same, but at the other point, it was different.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. President Kiir has ordered Interior Ministry officials to replace immigration and police officers that are deployed at Juba International Airport because, he says, the officers have been harassing foreigners entering the country. The president says that behavior damages South Sudan's image in the eyes of international visitors. Manyang David Mayar has the story for VOA from Juba.
President Kiir announced the order in a written message on Saturday, the closing day of the Police Leadership Conference in Juba. Brigadier Daniel Justin Achor is spokesperson of the South Sudan National Police Service, which falls under the jurisdiction of the Interior Ministry.
We are going to transfer those who are currently working in the airport with another force. And these are well-trained police officers. They are working, handling migration issues. Some are in the border, some are abroad in our embassy, some are here in the headquarters, some are in the states.
Justin says President Kiir's order to replace officers working at the airport follows a series of complaints from both national and international air travelers about the behavior of police officers at the airport.
When you are coming to our country, you will first meet the police. So sometimes people reach conclusions about the country of based on the behavior of the police. If the police is very smart, welcoming, in a very nice way, then people will conclude that this country, the people of this country are very nice people and so on. But if the police is harassing people in the entrance or at the airport, then of course, people will think that the whole South Sudanese are the same.
President Kiir made clear his disappointment with the way police officers were treating foreign nationals at the airport during his remarks at the opening of the conference last week. Justin says the police and immigration officers removed from the airport will undergo refresher training on the police code of conduct and professionalism. Some Juba residents say they welcome the president's decision. Michael Duku, a South Sudanese who arrived in Juba this morning from Kampala through Juba International Airport, says he was surprised at the how well-behaved the police were upon his arrival.
It was very friendly, and it's really a new change that I have witnessed. In the past, sometimes they are sometimes rude, and sometimes they have to screen you. It takes much time in terms of probing or interrogation. But this one is more of a different change where I see they only look at your passport and whether you have an entry or not, and they allow you to go. No questions.
Justin did not reveal how many police and immigration officers are currently deployed at Juba International Airport. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayar in Juba.
Hundreds of thousands of people have been displaced by severe flooding across the Horn of Africa, including nine counties in central and southeastern Kenya. Errol Kekich, the executive director of the Church World Service, recently returned to New York from the flood-affected regions in Kenya. He says the severity of the floods in some parts of the country should urge Kenyan authorities to consider classifying the flooding as a disaster. That's what he tells Ayen Bior Deng.
What's happening is that the rains that normally last 3 to 4 weeks are not stopping, and they're topping the river levels across the region, not just in Kenya, but also in Somalia and Tanzania and elsewhere, and causing major flooding. In Tana River region in Kenya, things are pretty bad at this moment in time just because there was very little in terms of the warning for communities that live along the delta, and there was also very little place where they could run to reach a higher ground. So at this moment in time, it looks as if close to 400,000 people have been displaced through the due to the rains and through the floods. I think over 130 people have died in the aftermath of these floods.
We normally hear of drought as a big issue, but you're telling us that flooding is a really big issue.
Indeed, at this moment in time, and I think the two are really tightly connected because of the extended drought over the last several years, the ground, the dirt is completely baked and is as sturdy as concrete would be. So when these torrential rains come down, they create flash flooding all over the map and really force people to run for their lives. It happens really quickly without any warning, and entire villages have been flooded and or destroyed because of the rising waters.
You were just there, as you said. You just came back over the weekend. What are people doing there to cope with this issue?
Well, hasn't been an official announcement or declaration of disaster by the Kenyan government to the point. We don't know if that will be announced anytime soon. And in the meantime, that act itself is really preventing the large international community from stepping in through its international disaster response mechanisms.
Would you classify this as a disaster?
I certainly would for the Tana River region.
Who is affected by the flooding? What types of communities are impacted?
It's a good mix of communities that are, by and large, divided into those who grow land or grow food and work on land and those who are migratory and keep animals. There are a lot of minority tribe groups in this region, and usually largely undeveloped part of the country.
What are the long-term consequences of the floods in Kenya?
I think you have to look at the short-term, the medium-term, and the long-term. I think the immediate need is really to make sure that malaria and other diseases that are carried out when there are floods are not really taking a human toll on the situation here, which then, of course, extends into the long-term toll. The livelihoods are destroyed, so people are really do not have access to food or non-food items, and I think that has long-term implications on their health, specifically children under five, of whom there are many. I think the long term is that people will not be able to get back to their land in a long period of time, and even when they do, there will be a lot of cleanup to conduct, and I think all of the harvests are pretty much gone at this point in time. So that really extends the food crisis into the long term.
Errol Kekich, the executive director of the Church World Service, he was speaking to Ayen Dangbior from New York. In an energetic presentation, World Health Organization Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus has kicked off the agency's annual conference by vowing to use his position to keep the world safe and to serve the vulnerable by promoting health for all. Lisa Schlein reports from the opening of the week-long World Health Assembly in Geneva.
The overflow audience at the assembly enthusiastically marked the World Health Organization's 70th birthday. WHO Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus agreed there was much to celebrate, but noted there was little joy in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where health workers were risking their lives to stop the Ebola outbreak in that country.
It's concerning that we now have cases of Ebola in an urban center. But we're much better placed to deal with this outbreak than we were in 2014. I'm pleased to say that vaccination is starting as we speak today.
Tedros said this was only the latest of 50 emergencies in 47 countries and territories to which WHO has responded in the past year. He noted the best way to prevent future disease outbreaks and emergencies was to strengthen health systems everywhere.
That's why we established a high-level commission on non-communicable diseases to stop the premature and preventable deaths of millions of people. It's why we established an initiative on climate change and health in small island developing states. It's why we're working on an aggressive new initiative to jumpstart progress against malaria, an entirely treatable disease that still kills 500,000 people every single year.
WHO has rolled out an ambitious new 5-year strategic plan, which aims to make a big impact on health. Tedros said the goal is to achieve the highest attainable standard of health for all peoples in the world, poor and rich alike. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Climate change on parts of the African continent has been dramatic. Ruben Chama reports for VOA on what those changes mean for agriculture and farmers from Nairobi.
Agriculture, a major employer for millions of Africans, faces enormous challenges as a result of climate change. For example, the UN says sub-Saharan Africa receives only 5% of climate funds promised to assist countries in need, despite being one of the most vulnerable regions in the world. Farmers say they are not getting the help they need fast enough. Timothy Larpey is a nomadic pastoralist from the Maasai community. He says fluctuating rains and dry periods are taking a heavy toll on local communities who don't know what to do about it.
We must educate our people. We must tell them what is climate change, because they don't understand. They keep waiting for the rain, thinking the rain is everything. Whereas we know really climate change is real, but people don't, they are not aware. They're just saying, we hope maybe in the next few years it will rain. Maybe in the next few years it will rain. But the rain never comes.
Sebastian Gray is a senior researcher with the International Center for Tropical Agriculture based at the Regional Office for Africa in Nairobi. He agrees with Larpe.
As you can imagine, one of the main risks is related to climate change and weather variability. In many countries, the weather is getting more variable. Seasons are changing. Farmers don't know when to plant. When will the season start? How long will it be? These are key risks, and we need to help farmers to identify how to mitigate these risks, how to cope with these risks and adapt to them in the long term.
Gray says his center works to promote innovative agricultural practices that would help farmers adapt to changing weather patterns while reducing emissions and boosting food security.
For example, in Zambia, in a small town called Kafue, an integrated crop livestock approach to climate smart agriculture seems to work best. So this is understanding What are the cropping production practices? What are the livestock production practices? How can they be combined to make agriculture more resilient and more efficient? So, for example, combining manure from livestock into the cropping system, using crop manure for biogas, integrating legumes into maize production systems. This sort of integrated system seems to reap greatest rewards.
Kafue's integrated crop livestock solution adds groundnuts or sugar beans to crop rotations to fix nutrients to the soil. There is also success in Rwanda, where improved soil fertility through land conservation tripled the yields of soybeans and maize. Gray explains.
Regardless of the crop that you are planting, there are climate resilient practices that you can implement. One of the promising practices is drought-resistant and drought-tolerant breeds and varieties. This is both livestock and crops. So for maize, for example, there are many varieties of drought that are drought-tolerant that are better suited to the local conditions that can be adopted by farmers. The same goes for livestock. Understanding the local conditions and the most appropriate breeds for those local conditions is crucial in building the resilience and productivity for smallholder farmers.
But funding, particularly in Africa, is severely lacking. Some say investing in African agriculture remains still extremely risky. The Zimbabwe-born agricultural expert explains.
We have to go down to the farmer level and understand what is appropriate for them in terms of culture, in terms of the environment, in terms of the costs and benefits. Going down to the local level can enable you to design more appropriate investments and, as well, attract private sector investment.
Specifically, Gray says the smart technology that would help farmers adapt to climate change is funded by donors. He says Africa will not be able to boost food production unless the continent takes several steps on its own. They include encouraging Africa's private sector to invest in food production and in developing new technologies that help farmers. Gray adds that means governments will need to develop new strategies, including microfinancing, that will help make private sector investments in agriculture less risky. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
That's our show for this Monday. We leave you with a song, Interini, by Fatoumata Diawara. Jarabi tala yoro jana ale maso sigima Nderini nderini ngabe disa ne jarabi ma pega nyalo nyala Nderini nderini ngabe disa ne kanu I want to know. Thank you. We've been listening to Fatoumata Diawara with the song Interini. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Thanks for listening. Let us know what you think about our show. You can find us on the web at southsudan@voanews.com, or you can reach us on Facebook. Our title is South Sudan in Focus. We hope you join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. La vita, la guerra.